Okay, we're on to, we're not going to take the break now. We're going to do this and then take the break after, so we can break before the executive session. So item number 11, in-season management. This is briefing and public hearing. And we have John and Steve.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, Director, Deputy Director Store. Thanks for having us here today. My name is John Long. I'm with the Fish Program, and I work primarily on salmon management issues. And with me here today is Steve Teasfeld. He's the Region 6 Fish Program Manager. And we're here to talk to you about the status of coho stocks throughout the state. Understand that you have a lot of interest in Grace Harbor specifically, and we're going to focus a fair bit on that, but we'll talk a little bit about the rest of the state as well. And we're going to discuss in-season fish reactions that have taken place so far, and we're going to talk about what some potential plans might look like from here on out as well. So if you think back to the beginning of the season, the salmon season, we started seeing indicators that it was going to be a different season this year. It was kind of a strange season. So one of the things that I remember, and others in the department remember, is, and perhaps you as well, is pink salmon. Pink salmon, it's an odd year, so pink salmon came back, and there weren't very many of them, and the few of them that were around were pretty darn small, and they were running about 2-3 pounds. Normally they might run around 5 pounds, and so that was kind of a ominous indicator. Another thing that we saw after that was that Puget Sound coho were indeed small body sized as well, but the catch rates on them were pretty average in marine areas. For example, we have a test fishery and an active recreational fishery in Area 5, and one of our staff kind of put together an in-season update that suggested that, you know, abundance of those coho, although they were small, was fairly reasonable. They were fairly abundant, decent abundance. But as the season progressed, we started to see that throughout Washington and Oregon, it looked like coho were returning below preseason forecasts. So things were starting to not look quite that good, and it wasn't just in Puget Sound. It was kind of all over the state and into Oregon as well. So as we started stepping through the season, we began to take some fish reactions. We did some salmon fishing closures in the Skagit and Stillaguamish and Snohomish and the tributaries. We left open some areas around, like the Cascade River, for example. And one thing to note about these is that these were coordinated efforts with our co-managers. We had meetings with our tribal co-managers, and we were debating different kinds of indicators, why the fish were so small, whether or not those were really age 2 and not really age 3 coho, all sorts of things, what the fecundity would look like, lots of information, lots of debate on what that meant. Long story short, we felt like it was appropriate to take some action, close fisheries. Tribes did similar restrictions for their fisheries in these areas as well. Also along the same lines in the Green, up near Seattle, we also went to a coho non-retention fishery. Moving out towards the coast, we had closures for salmon and game fish in Grays Harbor, and all types of fishing in various tributaries in Grays Harbor. There were also reductions in daily bag limits on the lower Columbia River and tributaries. And then even as recently as I believe yesterday, you might have seen one go out for the Klickitat as well, which was a reduction of a bag limit for coho to try and enhance our ability to make hatchery egg cake. And again, in that particular case, there were a number of these, the tribes, we were in constant communication with our co-managers and making decisions in concert with them to try and address those management issues and impacts. Continuing on, we also closed salmon fishing in Willapa Bay and many of the tributaries to Willapa Bay. With some exceptions to that, we retained hatchery coho fisheries near some hatcheries, and there was also a chum fishery retained in Nema. There was a tribal fishery that was closed out on the Queets River. Non-tribal fisheries, recreational fisheries, were very low impact and remained open. And then as we got further into time, we actually ended up reopening hatchery coho and game fish in certain areas of Grace Harbor tributaries near hatcheries, kind of a surgical strike, if you will, to reopen some hatchery coho opportunity in some select areas in Grays Harbor tributaries. And lastly, and maybe not least, tribal fisheries were also closed out on the Ho as well. So that's just kind of a thumbnail sketch that I wanted to give folks for a statewide kind of view and what we've been doing in very large, you know, 50,000-foot view. And I'm going to hand it over to Steve, and he's going to talk in a lot more detail on Grays Harbor specifically.
Good afternoon, everyone. I want to talk a little bit about our traditional management, especially of our commercial fisheries in Grays Harbor before we start on this year. We base our fisheries in the preseason on a model that we call our preseason planning model. It's a harvest rate-based model. We calculate harvest rates for the tribal fisheries, for the commercial fisheries, and recreational fisheries, and we plug this into a model. The harvest rates are done by week, and based on the preseason forecast, we can estimate a weekly predicted catch of fish, coho, chinook, and chum, for both the tribal and commercial fisheries. Traditionally, when we've seen changes to the catches, the actual catches compared to the predicted catches, we've attributed that to changes in the run size that happen. You know, our preseason forecasts certainly aren't perfect by any means. But because we generally set our fisheries on a rate, the expectation was that the lower abundance would have a lower harvest and we would still meet our conservation goals. And over time, we've made not a whole lot of changes to the fisheries in those areas. We've made some, but not a whole lot. We've kind of just let those fisheries go. And the tribes have similarly managed their fisheries on their side. This year, we took a different step, a different approach to Grays Harbor and developed, went back to some ways that we used to do things with in-season updates, trying to estimate what is the true run in the middle of the season. And I kind of wanted to go over some concerns when we start using in-season updates and where fishery managers feel comfortable and where we don't feel comfortable. Whenever we've got a run of fish coming in and we're not seeing or we're seeing a lot of fish in the fishery, it's an annual dilemma for us as to whether that run is larger than what we forecast or whether it's early. There's a run timing that approximates a normal curve, and if that curve shifts 1 or 2 weeks early, it could be that your higher than normal catch is just that the run is early rather than big. Similarly, if the catches are low, you're asking yourself, okay, is the run low or is it late? All of our fisheries that we manage, we have this dilemma every year. And there's a bit of poker playing in a way. You got to know when to hold them and got to know when to fold them. And there's some art to that. The other confounding issue for this this year's fisheries that everybody, I'm sure, is aware of is the drought situation we had. We had very low water levels throughout rivers and streams in the state of Washington, including the Chehalis Basin. And so how did that low water potentially affect whether fish were going to migrate into the bay or not? So let's talk a little bit about in-season updates. This curve here represents the average daily catch in the tribal fishery in the Chehalis, in the mouth of the Chehalis River. It's the very lower end of the Chehalis River. And from this graph, you can hopefully understand that early in the season, around the 1st of September, the catch is really, really low. It gets up to about 1% of the overall run during the second week of September. And peaks during this week, beginning around the 4th of October, at about a little over 3% of the overall run per day of fishing in the bay. So we're using this just as a timing curve for you to just give you an overall idea. And as I was mentioning earlier, if this curve shifts over this direction and the peak occurs over here, you may have the same size run you predicted, but it's early. But all your indicators suggest it's very large. Similarly, if this curve shifts over this direction, you're getting low catches. You don't know whether it's late or small. I want to illustrate how you can get yourself in trouble by folding too early with one of the most intensively and most expensively managed fisheries in the world, Fraser Sockeye. I wish I had this data for our fisheries, but we don't. This is an example. This is a real-life curve that I've pulled out of the packets that are distributed to the Fraser panel often. This is early Stuart sockeye. These folks have the luxury of having a marine test fishery on sockeye, paid for at great expense by the nations of Canada and the U.S. And this heavy dash line represents the expected run timing and abundance of early Stuart sockeye coming into the Fraser River. And what you'll see on these yellow dots are projections of what the run strength is based on the marine fishery. This marine fishery is actually out in front of Nia Bay. And from this, you'll see that early on, the marine fishery was suggesting that you were close to normal timing and abundance until about the 25th of June when the marine fishery crashed. And at that point, you're thinking, whoa, what's going on out here? We're not going to make our preseason forecast. This blue line happens to represent an acoustic array that's in the river, many hundreds of thousands of dollars of acoustic work there. It was also echoing what you were expecting from the marine fisheries out front. So if you had decided that you needed to make a change to your run size at this time of the year, right in here, were you going to be right or wrong? So here's the final run timing curve for this fishery. In here was where we were concerned about whether we could update the run and what would we have updated the run to here based on the information we had. We would have said the run was low, and we would have downgraded that run strength. Now, interestingly, in this particular example, if you were using the river data, by the time you got to this point, you would say, oh, the run's big, it's huge, we got to upgrade the run. We got to increase the overall run. So this example, you could have made a mistake either way based on if you made a move too early. And this is a concern for fishery managers of making that move too early. Generally, we want to see this thing peak before we have a good idea of what that actual run strength is. In this situation, the actual run strength was quite similar to what the preseason forecast was. But if we'd made a move too early, we might have gone either way.
Steve. Thank you, Mr. Harris. Yeah, Steve, I like you, were somewhat familiar with some of this. But the way they managed that fishery, they did not have any. This is 2015, I assume?
I believe I pulled this out of 13 or something.
Well, 15 was about the same way, and they, correct me if I'm wrong, they did not have a directed fishery.
We haven't had a directed fishery on Early Stewart's this run timing component in many, many years. It's just an example to try and familiarize folks with the types of in-season.
No, I understand that, but they have the distance between Area 20 mm-hmm. and the mouth of the Fraser to make a decision, which you folks don't have that same latitude when you're managing Grace Harbor. I mean, they got 150 miles to think it through, well, what you're going to have, you know. Yeah.
Generally, we want to be over this peak and know where that peak is and see it coming down to feel comfortable. So in 2015, we were hearing a great concern from our constituents about the low catches in both the commercial and the tribal fisheries. We knew that was going on. And we're playing this poker of, is it late, is it early? Or late and low? Which is it? And how did the low water in the tributaries contribute to that? We did examine some in-season updates. A lot of folks feel that we did that way too late. But I want to show you what we ended up with it towards the end of this presentation. I'll note that we haven't used in-season updates out there in the harbor for over 20 years. I don't know if I could find the last time we did. We believe this is a significant advancement in where we've been in the past, where these fisheries kind of operated on autopilot. But there's potential to improve what we've learned this year. The low water in the river. So this orange line represents the average flow in the Chehalis River. This is a porter a little bit upstream from the town of Elma and above tidewater influence. And from this, you'll see that around the 1st of October, this curve usually starts going up. In 2015, represented by the blue line, we had relatively stable flows through the third week of October. One little bump from a freshet here, but otherwise not a lot of water in the river. So there was this thought that these fish are holding out in marine waters. We had this data from Puget Sound that we knew fishing was average there. We had the in-season update from Area 5. All these things are bouncing around in our head as we're looking at these low catches and wondering where to go. So let's move on to the actual fisheries that were scheduled. I apologize the thinness of these bars, but I struggled with this graph for over an hour trying to get it to be more readable, but I'll try to walk you through it. So again, here's what we expect the run timing in the tribal fishery out front. By the way, I use the tribal fishery because it's been more consistent and there's more effort in that fishery than in our commercial fishery. So it's a better predictor of what's going to happen in the system. And again, this is just the Chehalis side, not the hump tulip side. So the tribal fisheries are these purple bars that are here. You can see they had scheduled a couple days, mid-September, 3 days, third week of September, 3 days, 4 days, 3 days. And here are the state commercial fisheries, 2 half-days during this week of October, 3 days here, 4 days, and then 4 days. No tribal fishing scheduled through this period, and then more days scheduled here into November. You might be able to make out that I've got a dashed line here during this week. This week, the tribes closed that fishery. So they did not fish those 3 days there. So the state fishery started just after the peak of the run. So we looked at our catches from that part of the run, and we had some concerns that we were actually more concerned about the Chinook catch and our Chum catch, which both exceeded our model predictions. We noted the low coho runs. We notified our advisors, both commercial and rec, that we were concerned about the catches in that fishery and that there would be potential changes. Our commercial catch from that week of fishing, 2 half-days, was 516 wild coho from the Chehalis side. So those would be 516 Chehalis wild coho. We let our advisors know that we wanted to take a hard look at this fishery that was occurring here beginning the week of the 18th. And I believe that actually started on Sunday the 18th. So during this week, we requested from the tribes their data from the previous week. They responded, were responsive to that request, and provided that to us. This in-season update that we had developed for that week, which happens to be week 42, showed that the Chehalis side of the basin was going to be well under forecast, about a third of what we forecast, and that we were not likely to meet our escapement goal. We were at least 2,500 fish below what we needed to meet escapement. Our commercial catch at that time was about 682 fish, and so we closed the last day of fishing in that week for a total catch of 1,200 wild coho from the Chehalis side. So there's a concern that if we would have taken action sooner on our commercial fishery, that we would have met escapement and could have kept the recreational fisheries open longer. But from this data, you can see that we could not have saved the 2,500 fish shortage by, even if we had not had any commercial fishing, we still would have been below escapement. So that was early in the week. I want to let you know that we did contact our policy representative from the Quinault Nation, let them know that we would close that commercial fishery on Wednesday. There was not an agreement at that time that we had a conservation concern. We had let them know how we had evaluated the run, but there was not support for the action that we took to close that commercial fishery. We met with our advisors the following day. We heard a range of concerns from them, varying from, if you don't think you're going to meet escapement, you need to close all the fisheries in the bay and in the rivers, to, hey, we didn't cause this issue, and you can't penalize the terminal fisheries, and especially the folks in the upper river part that haven't had an opportunity for salmon yet. On Thursday of that week, we had polished up our in-season update. We sent it off to the tribes. We had hoped to gain a concurrence with what was the actual magnitude of the run. Could we agree on an in-season update that would help define what our conservation burden was? We were not able to get a discussion on what an actual run size update might be. So at this time, there is no agreement on what the run size is, nor what the conservation burden truly is. Friday, we made the call to close our commercial fishery, or to close our recreational fisheries and our commercial fisheries the next week. And late that afternoon of Friday, the tribes finally got back to us and said, you know, we're going to go ahead and close our fisheries that are scheduled here, which is a significant step in our management of the bay, to have them acknowledge that we had a conservation issue. I can tell you, for the last 2 years, I've been hearing from them, there is not a conservation concern in Grays Harbor. So to have them actually acknowledge that we had a conservation concern and close their fisheries is a significant step. Again, we do not have an agreed-to run size. We do not have an agreed-to idea of what the burden of conservation is. So the following week, we did get a call back from the tribes. They were concerned that we had not actually closed all of our fisheries. We had left steelhead and game fish fisheries open. They indicated they thought that was what we were going to do. So there was some miscommunication there on what our step was going to be. In response to the concerns expressed by the tribes, we did close the rest of our fisheries for all game fish. At that time, we let them know that once we met hatchery coho egg take, we would be looking to open up fisheries on those hatchery coho, and that we needed some serious discussion about when to start fishing for steelhead in the basin, because there are impacts on late-timed coho in the basin. We also kept our commercial fishery closed that was scheduled for the following week here. So the week of November 1st, we had a pretty significant high water event that weekend prior, and fish were flooding into the hatcheries. We met our hatchery coho egg take. We were pretty certain about that around the middle of the week. We had enough fish in the ponds. We thought we could get there. The hatchery crews were spawning fish through the week, and at about midweek, we had fair certainty we were going to meet that early time component of the hatchery egg take needs. We notified the tribes that we were considering opening those hatchery coho fisheries. There was not a lot of back and forth between the state and tribes until Friday, when we notified them exactly what we were going to do. I think it's fair to say they are not supportive of our efforts. But we did open those hatchery-directed fisheries on Saturday. As John talked about, we tried to be as surgical as we could to fish only in places where that were close to the hatcheries, where we thought the hatchery coho were likely to be, and help make this the most defensible fishery that we could and minimize the impacts on our fish. I want to let you know that the estimated impacts of those fisheries right now are about 46 mortalities for wild coho. And maybe another piece is that we did want to try to remove as many of the hatchery fish from the systems as we possibly could. It's not the overriding reason, but there is a benefit to that as well from opening those fisheries. A little bit about where do we go from here. You'll hear in a few slides about the fact that we are going to continue to monitor the fisheries, the runs in the systems. But we've got a wait here that's ahead of us. And I just want to demonstrate why we won't know more about the wild coho run size for a little bit yet. So I've got two run timing curves I'll walk you through. One is sort of an early timed and one is a late time. So hump tulips is more of an early time. You can see that we generally have a peak of fish showing up around the first, second week of November. A fairly protracted run, clear out into February. But if you were wanting to make a strong estimate of what your wild escapement is based on what you see for spawning, you're going to want to be somewhere in this halfway mark to make a real strong estimate of what the wild fish are going to be. And if we have to wait there, we're looking about mid-December before we have this run halfway through. A later time stock like Satsup, this stock doesn't peak until the middle part of December, and your 50% date might be clear into Christmas. So it's going to be a little bit before we can say with certainty whether we're going to meet escapement or not in those systems and be able to say, hey, we can open up wild coho fisheries because we're certain we're going to meet escapement. In terms of our next steps for Grays Harbor, we're going to continue to look at these in-season update models. We're pretty sure we could do one as early as week 41, which would be about 7 days earlier than where we were this year. Would I have been successful at convincing the tribe 7 days earlier that we had a conservation concern? Perhaps not. We do know when we first broached the topic with them, we were unable to convince them. And we've got to have a discussion about when to open these steelhead seasons. We know that the early December portion, or sometimes even into late December portion of our steelhead fisheries, we catch more coho than we do steelhead. And this is our late-time coho stock. And this is both the state fisheries and the tribal fisheries. I got to tell you, I'm not looking forward to those discussions based on the discussions I've had already. They're going to be really difficult. So that's where we are with Grays Harbor, and maybe John could wrap up a statewide perspective. And
yeah, thanks, Steve. And so statewide, much like they're doing in Grays Harbor, we're going to continue to track what kind of fish are coming into our hatcheries to make sure that we're making our egg takes. And then when and if we do meet egg takes in certain systems, look to relaxing fishing restrictions. What goes hand in hand with that, of course, is monitoring our wild coho escapements, and we've of course got stock assessment stream surveyors on the ground as we speak, and so we've got data coming in on both hatchery and wild stocks, and we're going to use that to evaluate any potential openings, and we're going to be watching it closely. And of course we'd like to open things as soon as we possibly can when appropriate. And with that, we'd conclude and welcome any questions from you all.
Thank you. Very informative. Questions? Yes, Commissioner.
Steve, you mentioned there was a 46 wild coho mortality in Grays Harbor in that particular case.
That's associated with reopening those small areas for hatchery coho.
Okay, and that's just an estimate? It's not actual?
Correct. That's our modeled prediction of what those...
Okay, and so that's within allowable percentages for mortality threshold?
We don't have clear guidance on what's an allowable when we have fished below escapement. We have clear guidance of if the forecast is below escapement, and generally if we're forecast to be above escapement or the run is above escapement, we're supposed to manage to not exceed escapement. So we're actually... maybe not where we need to be, but there is not a guidance that's provided us as to what to do in those situations.
So you're still not at escapement?
Nope.
Okay. Might give an idea.
Commissioner Mecklen.
Yeah, and John's pointing out, so what is that impact? Our expected escapement was about 26,000 fish on the Chehalis side. We've been unable to get an update that we can provide for the Hump Tulip side, but we have traditionally not made escapement over there, and that's where we do the 5%.
5%.
Right, so we're 46 additional mortalities out of an expected escapement of 26,000. So it's a very small percentage. It's not like 46 out of expected of 500.
Okay.
Yeah, just one question. Is the harvest rate model you're in general use in other fisheries? You talked about the Stewart, but is it used in other fisheries? And are there other alternatives in terms of models that might be used that would be more appropriate for this situation?
There's a pretty much a standard use of a harvest rate-based planning model throughout the coast. John, I'm trying to think of Puget Sound, if we've got any that are based on rates as much. I know the FRAM model that we use is a bit of a rate-based model depending on which fishery you're inputting into it. You know, the other alternative, the other approach is you set a quota and you fish based on a quota. I don't know that we would be able to get there with our co-managers. I mean, that's part of the difficulty is all of those fisheries, we're working with the co-managers on those models.
Would that be a more appropriate model to use in these conditions? I can't see how it could be.
Yeah, I'd really want to think about that, Commissioner Minkins. You know, sometimes it's easy to sit here and provide an answer without fully understanding what the alternative would be and what the impacts could potentially be.
What I'm getting at is we're using a highly acceptable model that's used in other areas, and we probably can't improve on what we're doing presently under the conditions that we find in.
It's a standard type of model used for fishery management, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Using a quota-based type approach would also be pretty expensive. You'd have to be monitoring those catches through creel estimates that we're largely we're using catch record cards and those sorts of things for those fisheries. And so if you went to an in-season estimator, it's going to require a lot more work, of course, to do it. Not that it may not be appropriate in sometimes, but this is this harvest rate model has been used for many, many years with success.
That we'll have an opportunity to ask more questions of staff after we've heard testimony from people who are here. But that said, I have a few questions. This sounds somewhat familiar to me. In the Columbia River, when we were not making mistakes, but just seeing some errors in our modeling for spring Chinook that were fairly significant, we were missing some ESA targets. We came up with a system of backloading the fishery. So that's an alternative that, you know, I think we need to discuss here, where you make your run size prediction, you figure out in a normal year that this would allow a certain number of harvests, then you back off of it just to be conservative until you get to that point where you have more confidence about whether it's late or small. So that's something I'd like to hear a reaction to, and I guess I'll see what you think.
I would suggest that's a bit what we're doing with Chinook. When we forego harvest, when we know we're going to meet escapement or predict we're going to meet escapement. As we've done that for the last 2 years, we've not had buy-off from our co-managers on that. They've not helped us with that. I think that suggests that a co-manager agreement on a backloading of the fishery would be very difficult to accomplish.
And, yeah, we've definitely heard that issue raised. And some of us would like the state to take the high road, regardless of what the tribes decide to do. So there's strategies. Maybe we can challenge you to come up with strategies to see how we can be responsible, more conservation-oriented until we get confidence, because we do worry about the future being more like what we've seen this year in relation to coho, that the warm blob and climate concerns could mean that we're going into a period in which the forecasting of the past is just not going to be a good enough guide. I know you know that. So, okay, another question. You mentioned you're going to be monitoring. This is a real challenge. I think what we've been hearing is that you feel you've been getting the information from the Quinaults in a timely fashion, meaning that there was no long delay in which the Quinaults were not forthcoming. And since we were relying on their commercial fishery for this information, that's the only way we can monitor. I wonder if there might be other ways that we can monitor fish numbers without expending too much money.
Oh, you had to go there. I was just going to see if we had any more.
We
do not have a rigorous sampling program for our recreational fishery in the bay, although that certainly would be one place that if we had some funds to do that. We do know that the Area 5 look that we didn't work for us this year. Whether we could develop a more rigorous test fishery using commercial gear out there. That's a possibility. I don't know if I could pay for it with the catch or not. That's how our test fisheries in our Puget Sound commercial fisheries are conducted. And certainly on the Fraser panel, they try to use the proceeds of the catch to pay for those, but there are many years they end up having to supplement that with additional dollars. I'd have to really think hard about that, Commissioner Wecker, what other opportunities we might have. It would be easy for us to take a real precautionary approach in our fisheries, both in how we plan them and simply watching the tribal fisheries. But if you act too early, you're going to make mistakes occasionally, and maybe erring on the side of the resource is worth making those mistakes. But there are, it's going to cost economics to both the commercial and recreational fisheries if you make those mistakes.
And one final question at this point, reserving some opportunity later. The NOAA's issuance of the determination of overfishing mostly applied to Chinook runs, but there was the Queets Coho run that was included in an overfishing determination. So what would the impact be if we end up in the situation where a number of our runs are determined to be overfished, like PFMC? How would we do things differently?
I know it requires a lot of work and a lot of assessment on the management that's being applied to whatever stock is being deemed overfished. And harkening back to your previous two questions, it seems to me what we one other way is better forecasts. If we had a forecast that was more accurate or precise, then we would know how to manage perfectly in season. So having a forecast that's right or closer to right on the front end is also very helpful tool for fisheries management. And whenever we go through changes, periods where the regime or something is changing in the environment quickly, it's hard for those forecasts to catch up. But as time goes by, we do a better and better job of being able to incorporate some of those things, like you're talking about environmental conditions, like the warm blob. What is that? What effects did that have? And once you've seen how what effects it had, you can then use that in future years. And so, forecasting is an art in and of itself, and it's constantly being improved and edited and revised as we go through time. So I wouldn't rule out that forecasting is and improvements to those forecasts is I wouldn't say that that's out of the realm of possibility as well. I think that those continuing to refine those is going to help us in addition to continually working on in-season indicators as well, like Steve had mentioned with the bay fishery and creel analysis of those sorts of things. But specific to the overfishing reports, it's going to I don't have a specific answer, and so I could come back to you with some more specifics on that. But it does require intense investigation on in those areas, those stocks, those fisheries that are applying the impacts to whatever stock is deemed overfished, and looking at ways of reversing that, whatever problems are found in that. And it's a statewide kind of approach. It involves PFMC staff as well, and so it's a big undertaking that obviously, as managers, we don't want to have fish being overfished at all, and certainly don't want to do it for the resource nor for the amount of reporting and work that it would take to try and figure out what the problems were. We'd just as soon fix it on the front end.
I guess I read here on the back of our name placards, it says Sound Stewardship Official Wildlife, you know, trying to wade through that from these different agenda items sometimes is hard to split hairs. And but I read into that that conservation is our all of our ultimate goal and responsibility. And I guess thinking about what goes on in Grace Harbor over the years that I've been involved here is, are we conservative enough? And does conservation, what are the variabilities in conservation between your views and the tribal views on that system? And how do we bring that together so it kind of means the same thing for all the managers and we don't run into this situation year in and year out? Because we tried to work pretty hard to pass a policy for Grays Harbor, and we did pass a policy, but I don't have the sense that it's working real good. I'd like to make it work better. Thoughts on how to make our relationships across the different fishery user groups work better for the public and particularly for the resource?
Well, Commissioner Carpenter, I think if I had that answer at my fingertips, I would have employed it already. This is a tough nut to crack, and we've got our work cut out for us. I'm concerned that where our relationship is going in that direction. We know we've had some other tough discussions with crab issues recently. You know, the decision on the queets where we did not close the queets caused quite a bit of heartburn from our co-managers. I don't have an idea here in front of you today to offer. I'm going to have to think real hard about where we get there and maybe enlist the help of some of our senior staff as to how to do it. We know we need to do it, and I just don't know here today what that answer is.
I wasn't trying to put you on the spot, Steve, so don't take it to that, but we need to find a tool in our toolbox to do that. Because if we're not managing, we're not managing. And all the best efforts to go by the wayside, but the resource will suffer. And that's something that I think we need to fix.
I think Francis said it a few meetings ago, we don't want to manage to the last fish. Was that you that said that? But that's that one stuck always. So. Yeah. Any other questions from
Connie?
I keep thinking about the cost of management of this fishery. I mean, this is becoming an increasingly complicated situation. It requires a lot of effort to manage this fishery. And I know it's been a very valuable fishery in the past. Would you be willing to speculate on what the cost of management is today compared to the value of the fishery? On this year's situation, have you considered that at all? No.
Not on both commercial and recreational?
That's fundamental.
Our management costs are indeed higher than they've been before. We've asked more out of staff through the development of both the Grays Harbor and Willapa policies. The expectation of how we manage those fisheries has increased. The bar is higher. We are pushing staff to the wall, and in some cases, some of us are going a little loopy, having done so. We are going to throw some more resources into the district to try to help with that. The economic benefit to the state is still far exceeding what it costs us to run those fisheries without getting into the commercial versus recreational debate. It's a huge economic benefit in certain times and certain places, and I think it's still good value for the public as a whole. The hit that we took by closing the fisheries was significant. It is increasing, and maybe that margins shrinking, but I think we're still in good shape. I think folks also need to take a step back and think about, we did have this significant drought this year, And this is a coast-wide phenomenon on coho. It's not specific to Grays Harbor. So in a way, to have it happen in the second year of implementation of a new policy or the first year of implementation of a new policy down the south is very, very unfortunate. And I really hope that this isn't a precursor of the next 4 or 5 years, or we're going to really be struggling with management on all aspects up and down the coast. How we proceed next year is perhaps going to be telling of what the legacy we leave for the future.
Again, thank you, gentlemen. And we have three folks who want to testify. You all know the rules. Three of you that are coming up are well seasoned in the rules. But when the peepers go off, the seat projects you. The new rule. So, Tim Hamilton and Francis.
That's good. Did you say two or three? Two?
Three.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Tim Hamilton. I'm with the Twin Harbors Fish and Wild Advocacy. I live in McClary, Washington. We sent you a letter. It was a hard letter to write because it's time to, as Steve says, no one to hold them in the fold. First and foremost, had you not passed the policies in Little Pond and Grays Harbor, I can tell you with all good faith, we'd have blown escapement goals for Chinook, Chum, and Coho. We would have struck out in both bays completely. Now, nature threw us a heck of a couple of curveballs here, and hindsight is always better than foresight. But I sat down in September with staff. I could see the runs. We came in and predicted and laid out a format of data and things we were showing that showed the whole run, coho crashed, was running about 18 to 25%. The staff was extremely nervous about making a premature decision they could be criticized for. So they didn't, and they waited. And they waited until the point where if you put those last 3 days of the non-treaty nets in the water, you would see the reaction was, well, we can't reach the escapement goal anyway, so we'll just give them another 3 days of nets or other fishing opportunities for poles. And we decimated what – just because we couldn't get to an escapement goal doesn't mean we have to have none back in the water. And then we came in with a enhanced recreational opportunity, which I think a lot of the recreational fishermen appreciate the mentality. But what we did in the SATSIP as an example is we opened up for coho for hatchery fish. They're dark fish. They're up at the hatchery. It's caught up in the spawning grounds. People set up there, and we monitored it for 9 days, and they'd bring 40 dark spawning Chinook who are spawning right there where they put those fishermen back in. What does a native fish do when it has something come into his nest? It eats it. We saw two hatchery fish come out of there. Two dark hatchery coho fish. And we imposed an unbelievable mortality. We almost undid reaching escapement goals on Chinook. We got 45 days in front of us. The last of the native run coho are coming. The last ones. My grandson's coming for Christmas. San Diego. Never caught a steelhead, never caught a salmon. Timed it so he could go out on the SATSIP and fish. He's not going to be able to do it. But if I give him that letter I wrote you guys, he'll look at me and say, Papa, I understand. I understand. My question is, will the Quinaults and the Department of Fish and Wildlife understand? We have the last genetic connection of coho in that bay that we know of, that we believe is there. We said it, we put a picture out for you, and they're going to get them. We got time to figure out everything after New Year's, the next 45 days. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Francis and Mary Lisa.
Francis Estalila from Aberdeen. My face is familiar to everyone at the table, I think. I don't have a lot of prepared comments. I was going to read off of a post I made, but I think Steve already covered a lot of what I wanted to say as far as the only way we can really assess what's coming in is to put commercial gear in the water in this basin. We don't have dams. We don't have sonars. We have nothing to tell us what's coming in until it's pretty far along in the run. And the earlier you try to make that guess, the less reliable that guess is. I shouldn't say guess, estimate. And so I'd say that we have that data from the tribal catch to help us. Could we have done it a week earlier? Yeah, we could have. Would it have made a big difference? I think Steve showed you it didn't. But I will read something I posted on the internet forums. We need to keep the catch numbers in perspective. The Quinaults took nearly 11,000 coho for the season. The state nets took a whopping 1,500. Who knows how many the hook and line guys got? I think it's probably bigger than that, but we won't know for another year and a half. So that's the data we have to work with. Had we closed in week 43 completely, might have saved 600-700 coho. Maybe a couple hundred in the brack fishery. But the tribe took 2,700. They could choose gravel or they could choose totes. They chose totes. And here we are having to pay for it. The 2,700 fish they caught would have paid for the 2,500 deficit that Steve just showed you. We'd make it. But now we don't have guidance to make up this deficit. It's been fished down below escapement. We didn't create the conservation shortfall. The other side did. And yet, how much impact should we be made to bear to pay for that? And I don't know, that's a question for you guys. There was a question earlier about how could we fish different? How could we assess different? You know, you can fish salmon to a rate, which is what we do. You could fish to a quota, which was also mentioned. Or you could do like Alaska, they fish to an escapement. Certain number of fish must escape into the river before the big Bristol Bay fishery goes out there and goes for it. And if it looks like they're not making it, they shut them down for a little while. It's metered. X number of million fish must go into the Quechac before they go out again. I had one more comment I was going to make. Eventually, or ultimately, all comes to looking out for the gravel. And we really got to work with our co-managers and get on the same sheet of music for making sure the gravel is taken care of. Otherwise, we'll never get rid of this overfishing scenario that's already been identified for Chinook. And it will be for other stocks as time goes on. Thank you.
Thank you. Question.
Well, Francis, you raised something about the recreation. It takes, there's quite a lag before you get the data back from the recs.
There is. At least 2 years.
And I guess that's kind of strange. You're looking in on this.
And at 2 years, it's called a draft estimate.
As far as reporting, do the recs have to report?
How we do. We have a catch card. It's got 26 places in there to put a salmon down. And I know how many for steelhead, but you're required to return that at the end of March. And then it goes through the machinery that tabulates what fish, what species came out of which area.
And there again is a cowboy that has been drugged kicking and screaming into the 21st century as far as technology. I mean, what's at stake here? Why can't we be, you know, and there again, what would it cost? I know it would be expensive to maybe get initially set up. I know, you're reading my mail, dude.
End of the day, put in your catch, and it's instantaneous, but we're not there. I think that's where we're going to be eventually.
Well, that's what it keeps going through my mind is, you know, yeah, it's a hassle and everything else, but we may have to act like grown-ups, and that's part of the deal. And Steve, would that help you guys?
Yeah, the front of the network has been slow to them.
Yes. You know, there's a number of ways that we've employed to estimate recreational catch, and the way that we do it, that we have data immediately, is very expensive and depends on the area. But many of our fisheries targeting ESA-listed stocks, Lower Columbia and Puget Sound and the ocean, where we need to ensure that we're not exceeding those federally allowed impacts, we do have monitoring that is much quicker. And it all involves sampling of the fishers, the anglers, as they come off the water, and then generating estimates in real time to use for managing. It is much much better data. It's much faster, but it is very expensive. I know our sampling for Mark Selective Fisheries in Puget Sound at one time was about $2 million a year to monitor those fisheries. The other part is, just because you have that really good data doesn't always make the decisions you make any easier to take. So,
but it would still give you another tool in the toolbox, right?
Yes, and in this situation, if I knew exactly how many fish we had caught in the marine areas and exactly how many fish we had caught in the rivers, we might, if we could agree to a run size with the co-managers, make an argument that there were still surplus fish available. But right now, I just have a projection of what that is, and so that's all I have.
But I mean, if you tell the fishers, okay, you're going to either send them in once a day, once a week, whatever, and this is what's going to, your fishing season is going to hinge upon, don't you think people would do it?
We have some folks that are extremely technology oriented, and they would prefer that they could just enter it on their smartphone while they're out there fishing, and that would record for them that they have punched their salmon. And I believe we are working towards that. I'm not our catch record card expert, but perhaps we could drag Mr. Craig up here and let you know what his plans for the future are. There are folks that will do that. And then, I just received a letter this morning regarding the North Coast Steelhead proposals that, you know, hey, I'm not internet savvy. You needed to come up here to Forks to talk to us. I wasn't aware that these proposals were going on. So there are still a fair number of our constituents that, even if that was an option, they're not going to partake of that. And if we made it a requirement, I don't know if we would lose them. But certainly we need to get there. We've implemented online reporting for crab. We're headed that way for salmon. And sooner or later, we will have it available on a daily basis. How good it will be, I'm not sure. That's part of the dilemma. Do you make a big investment in that infrastructure if say, 30% of the folks actually utilize it? There's some work to do there.
But for this guy back here, yeah, I still use a flip phone. But I can go home at night and punch it in, or even like with your recording for your deer and elk tags, you can get on the phone and do it.
Yes, and we're headed that direction. And how long it takes us to get there, I'm not sure.
But I mean, to me, if people aren't willing to do that, they must not want to fish very damn bad.
Miranda? This started ringing bells in my mind about having heard recently about some volunteer efforts to try to organize creel surveys to provide data to the department, and some difficulties that arose in the course of trying to formulate this volunteer effort. I can call some of the people up from the audience if you'd like to.
Maybe I could take a crack at it.
Take a crack at describing what happened.
Yes. So one of the things that we don't have good information on often is the release of wild stocks, how many fish were released. We did try to improve our abilities to estimate wild fish impacts in Willapa Bay this year using what we call a voluntary trip report, which is where I think you're headed there. I know that there's some folks behind me that have said it's too doggone hard to do while we're out fishing. Whether there's more of those entries that make it less palatable to them than when you actually say, this is a fish I'm going to take home. That doesn't require quite the effort. But I do know that some of our voluntary recording efforts are not viewed very favorably because of the effort involved in it. So would they do it if it was required for them to go fishing? I'm sure they would, but they're not getting there necessarily. The carrot isn't very strong right now. We need a better carrot or a bigger stick. I'm not sure which. So.
Well, I would just point out that we just heard the great presentation on citizen science and the revolution that's taken place because of smartphones, so that millions of data points are coming in based on citizens providing this easily uploaded information. So Bill Twight just told us it's a snap. wanted to point that out.
Maybe we need to get Bill involved in the catch record cards.
I think we've got a couple of different rocks to look under here for a solution. And to look into the recreational side and think we're going to get a lot of bang for the buck out of there, Commissioner Holzmuller, I think it's the wrong rock to look under. I grew up commercial fishing. And later in life, I commercial fished in Bristol Bay and Togiak for Bristol Bay for sockeye, Chinook and sockeye, and Togiak for herring. And if you want to manage a fishery that has a gillnet fishery, you don't have to have 12-hour openings. I fished in Bristol Bay where Alaska Fish and Game would give you a 2-hour opening or less, depending on the target abundance that they would allow you to take based on getting escapement to the rivers like Francis, because you didn't fish until they had escapement in all their Bristol Bay rivers. Togiak, you'd get a 30-minute opening out of biomass of herring that were coming in, and you'd be done. And so if you're going to look and try and track what run size is, what run composition is, all the things that you guys work on, Steve and John, you can shorten the openings. You can shorten the soak time, and you can get the data. And a gillnetter can go out and make two sets. And if there's fish there, he can make some money. But he's going to give you more information than you're going to get from the whole entire recreational fleet.
Commissioner Grable.
Thanks. In my region, Region 2 on the Upper Columbia, we've been fishing on ESA stocks for a long, long time. We require that data. We have people in the field. It's required by NOAA Fisheries to not only provide a creel census daily, but also enforcement. And it is costly. It costs approximately $250,000 to monitor and enforce the fisheries within my region, which is maybe half a dozen rivers. But we manage it down to a quarter of a fish. I mean, our seasons are that narrowly monitored. And if we continue to manage these fisheries, we're going to be under ESA listings, and we're going to be paying for it, whether we like it or not. And the sooner that, you know, we get into a place, if we're not managing, if we don't get escapement and we don't have an appropriate escapement goals, we're just watching our fisheries decline. And that's got to change.
So I didn't hear a question in there, but if I could at least offer, Chehalis coho has not been one that's been traditionally not meeting escapement. It's been a fairly strong stock for a number of years. Humtulips coho, a different story, but we're really constrained our non-treaty fisheries on that side. So it's not that we're set in a, this isn't the fifth year in a row or five out of the last 10 years we haven't made escapement. This is one of our healthier stocks. I mean, we had 150,000 fish out there last year or something like that. So I think the bigger concern as we move forward is if the marine survival has changed, we're going to have to really rethink the way that we're doing things to ensure that we keep it healthy. Like I said, that it was part of why we wanted to have the framework up front of this was a phenomenon throughout the state. And so Grays Harbor is one of those places where it hit us, and how we respond in the future to me is the real critical issue of making sure that we don't get ourselves in a position where Coho are in trouble out there. So, and
thank you, Annette. You have the last word.
Commissioners, Director, my name is Marlisa Dugan. I have been here many times. I am here today, such doom and gloom everywhere. I wanted to make a point of coming here to say thank you for being part of creating the new policies for Grays Harbor and Willapa Bay. You have been instrumental in the movement to create change, and people have noticed. We are trying to reconstruct the natural origin salmon runs to promote salmon to selective commercial fishing and increase recreational fishing opportunity. These new policies ensure natural origin recruits a path to the gravel, an opportunity for Mother Nature to take its course, and, of course, to help us keep our eye on escapement. I mean, that is the goal. We have to do everything that we can to restrict what's out front, whether it's the QINs or the commercial nets, to make sure that our escapement's getting to the river. The proof was in the pudding this year. Unprecedented numbers of natural origin Chinook and Chum did return to our tributaries to spawn in both bays. To me, that means this policy is working. Thank you for making that possible. Thank you so much for getting those fish to the gravel. No one could foresee low water levels and warm water temperatures, which Mother Nature took a sideswipe at us. But if it hadn't been for that, I think that it would have been an overwhelming success with the Chinook runs in both of those bays. But vigilance is still needed to stay out in front of our escapement needs. This is no longer a put the numbers on paper and let the dice fall where they may management scenario. Recreational fishermen want to see meaningful numbers of salmon reach the gravel everywhere possible. For too long, the nets have stripped river after river of small, self-sustaining salmon runs, certainly where I live. Preseason forecasts should utilize all scientific data available, which includes the oceanic cyclic data, and adjust these forecasts early when it's pretty clear a serious discrepancy is in play, like this year's Coho run. Recreational fishermen should not be penalized for the blunders of the department's commercial harvest management or the over-harvesting by the QIN. Enough harvest impacts must be reserved for the recreational coho season from fish allocation to ensure a full recreational season. Let's be safe rather than sorry to salvage escapement and to maintain recreational fishing opportunity. Millions of recreational dollars spent to have this opportunity are watching. Protecting this revenue must be part of the WDFW's management plan. And just to finish, once again, thank you for your hard work, your endless, unappreciated volunteer hours that I know each and every one of you put in. For myself and many, many happy Chinook fishermen this year, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So with that, we will.
Do you want Steve up here anywhere? Anybody got any more questions?
I'm going
to.
No,
guess we're done.
Good.
Well, wait. Steve, can you come up here and just give us a next steps scenario, kind of outlook for? You said you'd be monitoring and figuring out what we're going to do with steelhead season. So, any specifics about?
Well, I hadn't thought too much about public process. I've been up at night trying to think of the co-manager process and how we get through that. That's certainly my biggest concern at this point. I don't know how those discussions are going to go. I think they're going to be very difficult. You know, the opening of the hatchery coho fisheries may have certainly didn't help us. My understanding is there's quite a bit of anger there. So, but we've got to start having those discussions and trying to figure out when's an appropriate time. I know that a number of our constituents have been looking at the data and the ratio of coho to steelhead, and we will certainly use that same information to try to make a case for holding back fisheries. But I think the important thing is, are we going to hold our co-managers to a different standard than ourselves? And if we're going to ask them to stay off the water, are we willing to do that as well? But if the idea that folks have that we're going to go dump our fishery back in place December 1 and ask the co-managers to stay off till January 1, I don't think that's going to work very well. So, you know, in terms of public process, we can certainly keep our advisors informed of what we're doing. You know, I don't see a lot of value in having a big public meeting. I mean, I know what our public wants. They want the rivers open as soon as they can get them open. So.
With that, we will take a break. When we